Dear ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the BioDock Full Year Results 2017 call. At our customer's request, this conference will be recorded. As a reminder, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. If any participant has difficulties hearing the conference, please press star key followed by zero on your telephone keypad for operator assistance. May I now hand you over to Konrad Glund, who will lead you through this conference. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you for the introduction. I welcome you all to participate at this teleconference where BioDock will provide and discuss the 2017 financial year reporting. From BioDock side, we have Inge Lüß, Chief Development Officer, and Hendrik Lievers, Chief Financial Officer, and myself on the phone. This teleconference is based on a press release released this morning and available on the website, and it is also based on a presentation which can also be seen and downloaded from the website. I start now going through the slides, and we will guide you through, and the management will share this slide deck in commenting on the different slides. Now, after page two, the disclaimer, you see the content we are going through, and I start with the corporate overview, and most of the slides might be known to you, so I will briefly mention the main outcome of the slide. Slide four broadly summarizes the development of BioDock with June 2017, mentioning the phase 2A results. We come to that later in much more detail. You see on slide 5 the management, and on slide 6 it reminds on the main hallmarks of AD, which are the well-known A-beta plaques and A-beta amyloid, the neurofibrillar tangles, and the neuroinflammation as a third hallmark. And on slide 7 you have concept and the approach we are following. You see the origin of A-beta, full-length A-beta, by two enzymatic steps, beta secretase and gamma secretase, starting from a membrane-bound so-called APP amyloid precursor protein and ending up, as said, with the full-length A-beta, which is truncated and modified to the red structures, which immediately start to aggregate and form soluble A-beta oligomers by an enzyme called glutaminyl cyclase and abbreviated with QC. These early aggregates impair with synaptic activities, you see by the arrow, and finally end up in the plaque. So we have the modified A-beta called pyroglu-A-beta, the formation of early aggregates or oligomers which directly act on synaptic activities, and we have the small molecule inhibitor of the enzyme introduced, which is PICO-912. Now on 8 is more chemistry, and you see on the left-hand side that pyroglu-A-beta on the lower part of the scheme is a ring structure at the N-terminus arising from the cyclization of the side chain of glutamate by liberation of water and by the action of QC, the glutaminyl cyclase. If you go on the right-hand side, it needs the truncation or clipping off of two amino acids, aspartate and alanine, to make the E, and E is the glutamate, the one letter code for glutamate, accessible to the enzyme QC, which transforms it to pyroglu A-beta, the PP glue in green. And then you see that this drastically changes physicochemical properties with respect to increased hydrophobicity, with the result of faster aggregation and beta sheet stabilization, and as explained on an earlier slide, rapid oligomer formation and leading to synaptic and neuronal deficits. Now the nine, and we explain now, or it shows now, our two concepts. One of the concepts is to inhibit the enzyme QC or glutaminyl cyclase by a small molecule inhibitor. It's pico-9-12 and it prevents the formation of the modified A-beta. And on 10, it shows the antibody approach that we have a very specific antibody for the modified A-beta, which binds and leads to a clearance of the existing pyroglu A-beta. Now, to put it in more perspective, on 11, you see on the both upper parts, on the left-hand side, the BACE inhibitors, which where still advanced clinical trials are ongoing with the companies involved. On the right-hand side, you see Lilly, AstraZeneca, and all the others. And on the left-hand side, you see the immunotherapy with the main compounds in development in phase 3, aducanumab, trastuzumab, and gantenerumab, and finally the BAN antibody, where we expect results still this year. The aducanumab, if I can remind you, is Biogen's, or in a collaboration with Eisai, is an antibody which showed early efficacy in a smaller trial, which is this compound is now in phase 2. And coming then to upcoming new concepts, we have the modulating pGlu IA beta level candidates with pico-9-12, our small molecule QC inhibitor in phase 2, and with Lilly's antibody in phase 1b, actually in 2 1b trials, and with PBDC06, our pyroglu A-beta monoclonal antibody preclinical. And this is shown on 12 again, pico-9-12 small molecule QC inhibitor, PBDC06 as the specific monoclonal antibody, and with the respective stages they are in, and you see that pico-9-12 has passed a preclinical phase 1 and phase 2a and is going now or is on the way to a proof of concept phase 2b study. 13 gives some information on ProBioDoc shares. I would not comment on that and go directly into the results 2017. And there are two slides on the highlighting the results, which I just want to mention. It touches the pico-9-12 with its positive pharmacodynamic and efficacy results in the phase 2a SAPHIR study. These results have been presented in November last year at the CTAD in Boston, and we have initiated a phase 2b core program. Extending indications, we demonstrated efficacy in a preclinical Huntington disease model. We have published the pico-9-12 pharmacology results, and the last bullet we have published in an academic collaboration and with co-crystallization and X-ray methods, a unique binding mode of the pyroglu A-beta antibody PBDC06, showing its high specificity. And the pre-last bullet, we showed positive results of the small molecule and the antibody in combination in an AD animal model, where we showed that the combination is additive to the each of the either pico-9-12 or PBDC06 alone. Now, next slide 16 summarizes highlights from the corporate view, the tax liability settlement, the annual shareholder meeting, and the financial figures, which we will explain again. We had just 2 weeks ago a talk at the prestigious American Chemical Society as a post-period highlight, and I want to refer who is more interested and more extensively and has a more extensive read on the operational review, I would refer those to the appendix. And with that, I hand over to Hendrik Lievers for commenting on the financials.
Yeah, good afternoon, everybody, from my end as well. We are now on slide 17, which is summarizing the same format you are used to from the previous years, our key financial figures. I shortly guide you through. We had an operating loss of 9.9 million, which is significantly below the previous year, 2016, clearly reflecting that in mid-2017, the Sapphire 2A study came to its end. We booked a financial income of 850K and an income tax gain of 1.1 million. So that you have the interesting situation for biotech that the net loss is well below the operating loss. What is behind, without going too much into detail, we were in the fortunate position that we could finally settle and resolve the tax liability issue, which was pending since more than 10 years. And end of last year, had a book value, a negative book value, of course, of close to 3 million. And effectively, we paid out around 750K to the tax authorities, with that settling everything. And thereby, we could release the remainder, which is close to 2 million. And due to bookkeeping procedures, this is partly allocated to financial income and partly allocated to income tax gain. Don't worry about the details. All in all, this is the settlement of the tax liability. We had year-end an equity of 8.9 million, so that a net loss for the year of 8 million and 8.9 million equity, that translates in an equity ratio of around 83%. And due to the capital expenditures, we had the balance sheet shortened from 22 million in 2016 to 10.8 million in 2017. The cash flows were minus 12 million last year, which is below 2016, again reflecting that at some point in time Sapphire 2A came to its end. This is roughly a monthly cash burn of 1 million in 2017. We then had cash flows used in, or better, from investing activities, which is 460K. Positive, interestingly, what is that? We released a insurance for pension liabilities, which, according to plan, did expire end of last year, and the money is paid out to the company, and this is reflecting in that 859K. Cash flow is provided from financing activities, 127K. This results from the exercise of options, and that exercise of options also explaining why our shares were increasing slightly by 21,000 shares. We closed year-end with 10.3 million in the bank, which, as you may have read in the press release, is giving the company a cash runway well through 2018. On the personal side, not much has changed. Due to hirings, we increased by one, and the average number is, interestingly, the other way around, slightly decreased, reflecting that it is an average. We hired around year-end last year. The loss per share is 0.98 Eurocent in comparison to 1.2 euro last year. This is reflecting the reduced net loss and the slightly increased number of shares. On slide 18, the next one, you see a little bit more details of financial results, which do not go beyond the information provided in the press release. So once you have read the press release, you have the full picture. This is describing here in a more graphical manner what I just outlined. Maybe I can draw your attention to the operating loss. The operating loss, as you know, it consists of R&D and G&A expenses. And in the case of ProBioDrug, the allocation is roughly 75% for R&D, versus 25% for G&A, and G&A is including completely the IP costs, which are pretty high at ProBioDrug. We trust this reflects that we have a very efficient capital use, dedicating our money mainly to the R&D part. And with that, we are already through with the financial results. On the website, you find the numbers also according to German GAAP, Handelsgesetz through HGB. The numbers do not deviate too much. The main deviation is just that according to IFRS, as you know, you book expenses from issued options, whereas issued options are P&L neutral according to German GAAP. That's basically the only difference. And with that, we are already through with the financials, and I hand back to my colleagues.
I think it's now my turn. Inge Luys, welcome to all of you, also from my side, of course. I hope you can hear me. Yeah, is that?
Loud and clearly, Inge.
Yeah.
Everything fine.
Perfect. So then let's start with stage number 19, and that is intentionally overview of what we have been done so far in terms of clinical development strategy of our CQ912 and what we are planning to do next. And I will get back to some of these components because I think it's important that we see that there is a clear frame. It's going along also the framework that is provided by the regulatory agencies, what they request, and that also includes the update of the guidance for Alzheimer's from both regulatory agencies, the FDA, as well as the EU. I will get to that at a certain stage. So you recall, of course, the phase one. We had a comprehensive one. We also included elderly because that is the target population. And we got a very good understanding of the PK/PD, so what is the exposure in the brain. We could quantify the dose dependency of the target occupancy. That means the level and degree of QC inhibition in the CSF, which stands for QC inhibition in the brain. And that was the first part. And the second part is, and that is why we are doing the phase one in the first place, of course, is we were looking into the safety and tolerability as a primary outcome. And that is probably something which I share with you at this stage. You might recall that even with the highest dose in the multiple ascending dose of 2 times 800 milligrams, we didn't achieve a maximum tolerated dose. And so because the profile, tolerability, safety profile during this 7 to 11 days of treatment was really very clear. So then that brought us to the design. All what we learned from phase one was, of course, very instructive for the design of the phase 2A study. And the focus here, of course, was on safety, again, because it's first time a QC inhibitor, first time CQ912 in patients. And we had several secondary markers or exploratory markers, again, which should be very instructive how to design the next study. And in the next couple of slides, I will first of all, and many of you have already seen the results of the phase 2A as we presented them in the press release in June. Some might have seen already the presentation, which was given by Philip Skelton at the CTAD. But I will share the key essence and what we learned and how that has taken into consideration for the design of the next steps. I will go there. In slide 20, it's just in 2.5 sentence indicated, so what dose should we go? So in that first patient treatment, due to the good tolerability, we said, okay, we didn't reach maximum tolerated dose after 1 week or 11 days in volunteers. So let's take exactly this high dose, which gave us 90% target occupancy, nearly 100%, and see if there, with longer treatment in patients, do we capture early on safety and tolerability signatures and signs. The second question, however, was at the same time, with very high target occupancy, which increased, of course, the likelihood that we would see an effect, that we evaluated then on secondary exploratory outcomes, which is shared with you in a minute. Because, as you know, for the phase 2A study, we had only this 12 weeks, limited by the tox data we were not available at that point in time, which are, of course, now available for very long treatment periods. 21, that's also a slide you might have seen in several presentations. It's just a kind of reminder. On the left-hand side, you see what we have been doing, where, in 7 countries. Philip Skelton, who is really a very well-known, very renowned, and at least in Europe, a clear leader of the community, and in Amsterdam. So in terms of patients, we had patients 120, one-to-one randomized, and the next bullet points all indicate what we have tested to make sure that mild cognitive impairment or mild ALD, which is captured by the MMSE, the mini mental state examination, is indeed due to Alzheimer's dementia deficit. And that is nowadays state of the art, and that has been clarified and defined by very many working groups. And is indicated here, as already mentioned by Conrad, in June 2017. Let's focus on the right-hand side. So the primary objective, as I said, is safety and tolerability. And I will get to the results and to the conclusions. And then we have a very rich basket, I would say, in terms of different qualities of exploratory readouts. Let's go to the lower box. We start with cognitive readouts. So we dared to include cognitive readouts at the very beginning for a 3-month treatment, and used a neuropsychological test battery, and that compose individual tests which have been shown to be very sensitive early in the disease, and these neuropsychological test battery, which has been provided by Cogstate, which is, I think, the world's biggest provider, also keeping then, of course, a lot of historical data. And the NTB is accepted and validated by the regulatory agency. And then we had an interesting parameter, which I call here physiological function assessment, and that is the EEG. And I will discuss the EEG and what we can get out of the EEG a little later when I come to the result section. And the third basket then is what people are very often asking for, and how about biomarker? Being under the assumption that biomarker is easy to capture, you can get access to CSF and even blood. Yes, we have evaluated several types of molecular marker, which all fit with the concept or all related to the concept we are pursuing. I'll get in detail to that. In 22, it's only one slide, but that covers what we learned in regard to safety and tolerability. So if we calculate and if we register all adverse events or serious adverse events over all organ classes between control arm and treated arm, there was so no significant effect. However, we have seen something which was clearly increased or different compared to placebo, because we had a significantly higher number of patients who discontinued within the first weeks of treatment with the high dose 800 milligram BID compared to placebo. And if you would like to learn more, so it was about 21, 60 out of them stopped prematurely the intake of the tablets, but they still stayed in the program, so they showed up at the end of the study. Only 5 patients out of the 120 dropped out and withdrew consent, but that was for very different reasons. So what is the essence, what's the reason for premature stopping taking the drug? In the first place, it was seen that we have clinically relevant difference in the number of patients which suffered from some skin effects. It's only grade 2, 3, not that serious, and a couple of patients also reported GI effects, but that was not that high compared to the skin effect. But it's also important, they appeared early in the study, but in terms of skin, only after 10 days, so there's probably no chance to see this effect in our MAD, and they are very well reversible. And other than that, if you look into clinical chemistry and what have you, there, that was pretty clean. So the overall conclusion is that there is no major safety concern associated with GQ912. And that is one of the important guidance, so how to design the next study, that we have measures and means to further increase the safety and tolerability. And I will share that with you in a second. In slide 23, that's a composite slide showing the 3 readouts which have been shown before. Let's start. What could we see in the spinal fluid? First of all, we could, and I've indicated that already, a strong QC inhibition means the target occupancy, again, more than 90%, completely confirming what we have seen in phase 1, and that indicates that the dose response in terms of target occupancy is quite robust. On top of that, what could we see in the spinal fluid? We have a strong trend to reduce a synaptic marker, neurogranin, and an inflammatory marker, YKL. Both of these markers are enhanced in early AD compared to cognitively normal elderly. So, and now with the reference to what Conrad mentioned in the very beginning, we were, of course, keen to see in the right beginning, based on the mechanism, so could we see at the level of neurogranin, which correlates to the integrity of the synapses, could we see something there? And also in the context of the nowadays very well-known inflammatory process which is going on. And in both cases, yes, treatment brings these markers towards normal, in the direction of normal. I promise to talk a little bit more about the EEG. Everybody has seen an EEG, has had an EEG, or the electrodes on the scalp, and then there is a lot of oscillations, and these oscillations are divided according to certain frequencies, and these patterns are changed during the development of Alzheimer's. And one characteristic change is that the theta power or theta oscillation That is the oscillation which comes typically between 6 and 11 hertz. That is increased in Alzheimer's disease. And we could show significantly that the treatment with PQ912 push the theta power back towards normal. And that was really very significant. And then, and that's indicated also here, we did a post hoc analysis and looking not only into the first part, the specific waves which reflect the synaptic function. The synapses, as you know, are those structures which interfere with the communication between the neurons. And then we have the second level, which is called functional or brain connectivity, which you can evaluate if you compare the various electrodes and what happens, indicating how fast, how intense is the communication between different regions of the brain. Again, here there is a very systematic or very characteristic pattern what is changing due to AD. And as indicated here, I have that in gray. It's post hoc. It is not, was not predefined, but it clearly shows that it seems that there is also improvement in brain connectivity, and we definitely will look into that in more detail in the next study. And then we have the last, it's the neuropsychological test battery. And even here we were, yeah, positive surprise, because many people said, okay, within 3 months you won't see anything. But what we have seen is also very consistent with the mechanism of action, what happened on a functional or molecular way. So we saw a significant improvement in one of the tests which belongs to the working memory. So that is setting and organizing your task, your thinking, translating thinking into doing. So that is a working memory, an important part. That working memory is impaired, and due to the treatment, we have an increase here towards normal. And the increase is, just to give you a number so that you get a taste, so the increase is 30% towards normal within three months. That's great. And the expert we are having included here, he was very excited to see that we even see an effect which is not yet significant in the detection test, which belongs to a broader domain of attention in general. And so we have two components which we can consider as being the earliest, because very sensitive, which would react on that treatment. So we have clear mechanism of action, significant effect on synaptic function by the EEG, and the improvement also in cognitive components. That's very good, because it's not the single one. You see that if you talk about D stands for Cohen's D, 0.45 is small to moderate. That is not the point after 3 months. I think that the biggest value here is that what we have been evaluating and where effects are seen are all pointing into the right direction. And it goes without saying, it's not mentioned here, but we are interfering with CNS activities, but there was no negative CNS activity in terms of depression or something like that. So that also needs to be mentioned, of course. So then we have the result in 24, and I think it covers everything what I described during when I guided you through the different slides. So we have the skin and GI signal, and that also leads to the conclusion that in patients after at least 3 months treatment, we have met the maximal tolerated dose. And it's also important to mention, if you look into the recent guideline, European guideline, there is a clear indicator that the sponsor should come up with a maximum tolerated dose either in phase 1 or in phase 3A. So that has been fulfilled. But don't be afraid, because we have leeway, we have flexibility due to the fact that we are using a dose which has very high target occupancy. We can go down, and I will show that in more detail in one of the next slides. So that was the primary endpoint. The secondary, as I indicated, pointing into the right direction, very encouraging. The conclusion is that we have a rich set of information to design for an optimal design of the next study, and that is what I will briefly summarize in the next slide. So we decided, you know, and we have shared that with you, that we started the planning phase considering by taking the requests from various stakeholders into consideration. First of all, of course, the regulatory agencies. We planned for the proof of concept study, 2 studies, one to be run in Europe, and it's called phase 2B or proof of concept, part 1, and it will also be done again by Philip Skelton. And it's mentioned here, and also mentioned the different points, that we really take it very serious and have it tailored to the new FDA as well as EMEA guidelines. So in essence, the European study, and have 2 more detailed slides to really give you a flavor of how it is designed. The stage 1, that will be tolerability dose titration. Because for the time being, we know that with the 800 milligram BID, that we have some skin effects which are really reducing tolerability. So we have to work on it. How can one do it? That is by titrating the dose. And we will start with 150 going up to 600 milligram BID. And wanted to find out whether 300 milligram or even 600 milligram would work. And for that first step, we include in total 90 patients, 60 on treatment and 30 on placebo, and we will do that for 3 months. And after the 3 months, we will reaffirm what we have seen in the SAPPHIRE study in terms of biomarkers and EEG. And then we will have the option to go to stage 2 if the tolerability meets pre-specified criteria, which is done by the Drug Safety Monitoring Board. And if we have defined the criteria, and if we meet or are below the pre-specified criteria, we can go on, and that is what we have in mind, and looking then no longer into the safety as a first instance, but we need to look into the efficacy. And that is also described a little bit in more detail. So the second one will be run in US. It will be a longer one. And the collaboration partner will be the Alzheimer's Disease Corporate Study Group at the University of California in San Diego. And we are really very happy to get them engaged. Maybe it's interesting that that is not a classical CRO, but that's a research-based CRO. They have their own vision. They wanted to bring new programs to proof of concept. So there is a steering committee of 35 American-based investigators, neurologists, and they are sitting together evaluating whether a program, for instance, like ours, will be presented. Are they interested based on the science, based on the attractiveness, based on what they feel the likelihood of effect is. And only after their vote, our program, positive vote, our program was taken up into the ABCS pipeline. I think I was happy about that because that tells you that there is also some external review of what we presented and what we have in place. So we will also do, but that's not shown here, but we will share that with you in more detail once we have really the whole protocol in place. But what I can share already with you is in that context, we have developed an NIH grant application with Howard Feldman. He is the leader of the ABCS. He was very keen because the NIH was asking for proposals for programs like ours, and we applied for a grant. It was the beginning of February, but the success rate is about 20%. So let's see whether we could convince the NIH experts. We will know that probably midsummer, so it's not clearly defined. And there is one aspect here which I also wanted to indicate, that if both studies meet the primary and key secondary endpoints, there is, and that has been explicitly phrased now in the new guidance for early AD by the FDA, that there is an option to discuss accelerated conditional approval. And I would assume, although the European guideline didn't say that explicitly, however, what they said is, and I can encourage you to read that up. And they say there is, of course, a lot of drug failures, and it is noted that in many cases, the early trials did not provide proof of concept to inform phase 3. And consequently, the large phase 3 trials failed due to be confirmatory. And what does it mean? So the proof of concept means I know I have already statistically significant and meaningful outcome. And meaningful outcome in this context here means cognition. And in many cases, so people were based on reduction in plaque and then jumped into phase 3. And that is what they elaborated on, that there is a strong, very strong recommendation to really do a first of all, a proof of concept study and encourage to be conducted before phase 3. And I think that's a very important message we get. And that's the reason why I wanted to share that with you. And there is one or two other slides, and you can look into it, because I mentioned, yes, what can we do? 800 milligram BID might be too high. And for that reason, I showed in 26 what is the correlation, dose on the one hand and the target occupancy of UC inhibition. You see on the very upper right of the curve, there is the 800 milligram. and that brings us to 90%. And that was, as you heard, not only the case in elderly volunteers, but that was also the case in Sapphire. So that's very high. But due to the fact that the dose response curve is flat or shallow, you can reduce the dose without reducing to the same extent the target occupancy. That is the matter of the curve. And you have seen what we intend to do. So we will titrate between 150 BID, that is exactly 50% target occupancy. 300 milligram will be 70% target occupancy. And 300 versus 800, so it's only 40% of the 800 milligram dose. So that gives us really a very granulated view where we are with what dose in terms of target occupancy. Extremely helpful, and that all comes from this very detailed phase one study, but now it turns out it was well invested to get it there. And then in 27, you see it looks like the compilation of the information similar to what we have with the Sapphire study, and I don't want to go through all the details here. Due to the fact that the number of patients are increased, we will need a higher number of centers and countries involved. We are really happy that Philip Skelton will stay on board, and so will many others of the European investigators which have been involved in Sapphire 1. So they are really keen, and when can we go forward? And the bullet points on the left side, the lower ones, I show that then in a graph in the next slide. And then you see the difference here. The primary objective is now to assess the efficacy on cognitive function in early AD by having and using a composite or composition of selected number of tests which belong to the neuropsychological test battery. And it's those tests which have shown differences in the Sapphire test. Secondary objective, we are of course going broader. We will have the efficacy on the complete NTB. On top of that, we included also a test for activity of daily living, so that goes into function. Because if you look into the different guidelines, there is a big debate, or debate no longer. So one should not only look in cognition, but one should also how the cognitive competences then are translated into function, into everyday living performance. And we will have, of course, the EEG to measure this very important effect on synapses and brain connectivity. And it goes without saying that we are still working on several CSF biomarkers and fine-tune it to adopt to also the recent and latest information which are published. And that brings me to the very last slide, because that shows it in a simple way. So the European study, how is it designed? So that is the first requisite. We start with 150 milligram for 4 weeks. 150 means 50% target occupancy. We go then up to 300, which means 70 or 75% target occupancy. And then it would go up to 600 milligram, which is 85% target occupancy. It's pretty close to the 90% target occupancy. And the patients are allowed to go up and down if there is adverse concern in terms of the predefined adverse event. And that has been taken care of by the statistician, of course, because it's done by defining the individual progression slope. Everybody then gets treatment until 36. You might wonder, Why is it extended to 84? That is because the patients who are randomized very early in the study, they will continue after 36 weeks until the last patient in the study reached 36 weeks. And why is it? That is, we will get 50 or 60% more data points, and that's extremely helpful, of course, if you have to do slope analysis. So that is the design, and next time I will share with you the even more complex design of the American study, of the U.S. study, and what I have included in 29 is nothing I will share with you, and I will hand over to Konrad, and I'm happy later on to take questions.
I think to continue the corporate review is taken by Hendrik.
Yeah. I keep it very, very short and leave then it open for the Q&A section. The corporate review, slide number 21, is summarizing a major event at 29, is summarizing an important event for us in 2017, our General Assembly. Why was that important? Apart from the usual topics, we had one, which was the creation of the authorized capital 2017, and to make a long story short, with that, our shareholder brought us in the very flexible position that while moving forward and considering potential future capital raises, Provider can largely work without the necessity of preemption rights and the respective processes. Or the other way around, while still being a German AG, Provider is legally, in the meantime, much more an Inc. than a German AG, giving us much more flexibility in the capital markets as far as capital raises are concerned. And slide number 30, also the corporate review supervisory board. The supervisory board got largely re-elected in the last General Assembly, and one board member, Mr. Keith Bean, resigned from his position end of last year for personal reasons. And with that, I would hand back to Konrad for the outlook.
Okay, thank you. I think, and to summarize, we have, Provider has developed a concept in Alzheimer, which clearly differentiates from other concepts. It has a clear scientific rationale. PICO-912 is a first-in-class compound and has passed a number of important steps and milestones, as Inge just indicated. And now we come to the midterm focus, and you see it in front of you on page 32. It's the execution on phase 2B, as just shown. We haven't touched yet the PBT-C06, but we want to continue preclinical development. We are in talks with the industry and want to conclude industrial partnership or partnerships. And to extend indication, we, of course, need further scientific analysis. And we mentioned Huntington, and we want to strengthen ProBioDoc financial resources. And on the next slide, you see on the right-hand side for 2018 some selected news flow. Inge mentioned the NIH grant application and the non-dilutive funding opportunities, and then the filing for European and U.S. or IND approval for PICO-912, and we want to also test preclinically the potential of PICO-912 in combination with BACE inhibitors. With that, I would conclude the part to present to you and hand over to the moderator for the Q&A session. Not saying that on 34 you have the financial calendar, and now comes the Q&A session.
Thank you. We will now begin our question and answer session. If you have a question for our speakers, please dial 01 on your telephone keypad now to enter the queue. Once your name has been announced, you can ask a question. If you find your question is answered before it's your turn to speak, you can dial 02 to cancel your question. If you're using speaker equipment today, please lift the handset for making your selection. One moment, please, for the first question. First question is from Jonas Allison, Investment Research. Your line is now open.
Hi, hello. Thank you for taking my questions. And thank you for a very detailed update today on your phase 2B strategy. That was very interesting. Just to clarify on a bigger picture in terms of timelines, so the European phase 2B and US phase 2B studies, do you see them running more or less in parallel or more in less sequential stage?
Yeah, it's a little bit, because we might be faster with the European study because we have already the network from the Sapphire 1 study. But in the end, it's a little bit sequential, but definitely not that we wait for a certain type of information before we embark. The way it is outlined right now, it might well be that the U.S. study will benefit from the outcome of our stage 1. So looking into the tolerability of the program in EU. So it's meant, yes, we will run in parallel, but due to the fact that EU might be somewhat later to start, they will probably benefit from the results in the first stage of the EU. Was it clear enough?
Yes, thank you. That's good. And so I think I may have missed, but what is the association with ADCS? So I mean, it's more specifically, so what will be the input and what is the financial arrangement for the U.S. study?
So their input, that's pretty clear. So they are a kind of CRO, but based in the academic environment. So they have all the skills and expertise in-house which is necessary to set up the synopsis, the protocol, and also to do the statistics and the biomarkers whatsoever. So they can cover by their own study of about 300 to 400 patients. In certain instances, they probably, as other also do it, they have to reach out to a specialized CRO. But they have a setup which allows to run from an operational perspective the study. Of course, not saying that all patients are included in the ADCS side, but include more than 35 and even more centers at the level of the West Coast and the East Coast. So it's a kind of hybrid between research and they as a research organization, they get funded, for instance, by the FDA, by the NIH, because it's very encouraged that there was an organization formed which really should look into proof of concept. As I mentioned in between, so many, many companies just looked into biomarkers, not powered for, even if they looked into cognition, it was not sufficiently powered. And that is really, that pays back now negatively.
Okay, thank you. I think that's clear. Actually, it sounds very interesting. But just to confirm on sort of financial side of the study, running the study. So does that mean that they would sort of basically run the study because they have in-house capabilities?
Yeah, of course. The sponsor has to pay for it.
Okay.
What one has to pay. And that's the reason why we were very interested, because the people were supporting it as there, that we would apply for an NIH grant.
Okay.
Would at least partly take up the cost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's clear now. Actually, that's clear. And so the last one then. Once I think you have mentioned that there's potential for conditional approval, before phase three. But basically, would then need data from both U.S. and European trials before you could sort of talk with the FDA for this conditional approval. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Okay, Okay. Thank you then. Thank you. That's all from me.
Thank you for your question.
Next question is from Joseph Adam, AX Security. Your line is now open, sir.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my questions. And thanks for the update on the Phase 2B design. I was just wondering, what approximately of those 250 patients, what proportion would be treated for over a year? And then perhaps secondly, in terms of the guidance, the recent updates to both guidance, I was wondering if you interpret any significant differences in those that might influence the design, a difference in design between the US and the European trial. Thanks.
I hope that I got your first part of your question. I'm not so sure with the second part of the question. So the way it's done right now, so we will probably get at least 50% more data points if we do it like this. So the study will not be extended, but it's just that we are waiting and allowing those people who entered early to go on until the last patient included reached the 36 weeks. And if we do the arithmetic here and calculating how many patients enrolled per month, so you can count with at least, as I said, 40% more data points. You have to cut it at the end because then you have only a few data points more, which are not that instructive. And the second part, Joseph, I didn't get your second part.
Yeah, okay. So so the updated guidance from the FDA and EMA,
yes.
I was wondering if having analyzed that, you interpret any significant differences between the guidelines. I mean, they're both obviously quite general and giving a lot of consolation to the fact that it's been incredibly tough and a lot of endpoints, et cetera, are exploratory. But is there any kind of flags in there that suggest to you that the US trial might have to have some design elements that are different to what you have laid out today with the European one?
No. So you know the guidance are pretty general in terms of they do not make any recommendation what cognitive readout to take. And that's different, for instance, if you compare that with older FDA guidance. So they said, okay, we are not recommending any more CDR sum of box or out of cock even. So let's restart it. We don't know, but the different tests have downsides, ceiling and floor effects. So let's sit together and let's decide what is clinically meaningful. And that is something which one needs to do, of course. And we didn't plan to use CDR sum of box, but we designed something which is new and which we will discuss, of course, with the agencies, expecting that based on the characteristics of the test would better fulfill to capture any effect at early stage.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Next question is from Brigitte de Lima, Danskanal Securities. Your line is now open, madam.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my questions. I'll start with three. Actually further to Joseph's questions on the guidelines, what would you say are maybe the two, three key elements that you used to design your trials that you would not have done had these guidelines not been redrafted? What are the key points that you saw that told you, okay, this is something we absolutely have to build in that we hadn't really reflected? You sort of mentioned a few things, but I just want to be crystal clear. And the second question would be on this possibility of filing on conditional approval. Appreciate that there's a high chance it will happen, but is there any chance your trials will be adaptive trial design so that you can go straight into phase 3 once you concluded the phase 2 portion to avoid say, a 6 month lag between the start of phase three and the end of phase two. And then I also wanted to ask a third question, just very briefly on the guideline without going into too much detail, but just for modeling purposes, should we assume obviously that the guidance is on a pro-Bradiac standalone basis, excluding any payments from potential partners? And would it be sensible to assume that the R&D expense will go down a little bit given that the first patients won't come in until the fourth quarter? Thank you.
To be honest, that was very much. So let's see at once. So you were referring to the question, first of all, based on the new release of the guidelines from the draft guideline from the EMEA, it's not really released, and from the European one, would we have done key things differently? And here I'm citing Professor Skelton. He said what they now put into guidelines, we have taken it already into consideration. But we are happy that that now gets a kind of blessing by the guideline. What we leverage, for instance, is that was my example, that the FDA in the past recommended these cognitive readout CDR sum of box. So it's not, they are not doing it anymore because they also feel that that is not appropriate based on the fact that depending on the stage on the patient, that there are too many components which are don't have a gain anymore, either at the ceiling or at the floor, and so makes them very unsensitive. So we are very in a very good shape here that we have the design, and we are encouraged by both agencies to talk to them what we have in mind. And the one key component here is, and that needs to be solved, clinically meaningful. That's an open, that's not an easy question, but that needs to be sorted out in an interaction with the agencies. And we feel that has a bigger chance compared to, yes, guidelines provide you with, we have to show CDR sum of box. And I have heard recently somebody saying, okay, solanosumab, they had ADAS-Cog as a primary endpoint. If they had taken CDR sum of box, it might have been much more positive. So that is all going along that line of thinking. And then there is also a second note here, and that is important, because, and that is different in the understanding of the pathology, and that is cognitively alone in itself has been perceived as not being sufficient. One always has to also show what the deficits in cognition means in terms of functioning of functional, daily functional organization. But now they realize that that is a continuum, and they allow to have a composite measure and including cognition and function. So these are all adaptations which are on the one hand related to latest understanding of the pathology, but also a lot of learning in regard to failed studies. And it's really, I think that was very electrifying to me when I saw that in end of February. The field has witnessed many failures, and the reason is they did not provide proof of concept data. And you might have heard that anyway. People have seen in a phase 1b, but the power was not there. They have seen a reduction in plaque, and the assumption was if plaque goes down, we will have cognitive benefits, because you are not treating plaque. You want to see cognitive benefits. And I have heard somebody saying, what are we talking about? Phase 3, in the past, it was called confirmatory study. So what do we have to confirm? But based on the fact that all these early studies most of them at least, were not sufficiently powered. Look into several of the programs which do at the same time those dependencies with not a very high number of patients in it. As I said, not powered really to see an effect on cognition. And that is what the agencies see, find out, and specifically the European agency expressed it in an impressive clarity.
Brigitte Hendrik here to your other question. What about the R&D expense? Shouldn't they go up when the phase 2B program is ongoing? Yes, of course. The financial resources of ProBioDrug need to be strengthened this or the other way in order to fully execute what Inge outlined in this call and also in the interactions before. And for that reason, under the highlights, you see the topics further strengthening of financial resources, which may happen either via a capital raise and or partnership or a hybrid or whatsoever. And that was, if I may circle back to the corporate highlights, that was the important thing about the last General Assembly, that exactly that we put on the agenda and asked for the maximum flexibility shareholders can grant us according to German law, and that was granted. And that is the background. Once the trials are running full scale, of course, the R&D expenses will go up at that point in time, but please have a look at the timeline Inge did present.
And then, sorry, thanks for that. I had this final question on potential adaptive trial design for the phase 2. I mean, as I see it, it looks like it's their standalone phase 2, but I was just wondering if there could be in the sort of greater format of an adaptive trial, if that can be added, or if you would have to do a complete independent phase 3 study.
You don't have to, if I understand your question correctly. So based on what we are showing here in terms of decisive parameter and degree of effect, and in the two studies here, because only the two together would fulfill the prerequisite to get accelerated approval without going into full-blown confirmatory study, because they then consider the proof and they consider it confirmation of the concept. Of course, you would have to do then studies in parallel. But the approval means you could go out and start the marketing activity.
Thanks. That's all very, very clear. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome.
There are no further questions. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. Again, question from Brigitte de Lima. Your line is now open, madam.
Yes, I just wanted to ask one more question, if I may. It's just on the biomarkers. Are there any additional biomarkers that you would be looking at in the phase 2 program?
Yeah, for sure. These are the biomarkers, the molecular biomarkers, you mean. So these are those, and you have more than neurogranin. So there is a couple of markers which could give you a little bit more granulated view. It's postsynaptic, presynaptic, and the assays are out there. It has been shown that they increase during disease. So that is a little bit around the synaptic marker. Of course, we are looking into the inflammatory part. As I indicated, it's very important that this pyroglue itself, that triggers then and activates microglia, and they do a harm in further boosting the inflammatory part. And so that's the reason why we are so happy that we see the YKL-40 changing. And so we will most likely include another marker in the context of inflammation. You have heard about TREM2. There are even antibodies targeting TREM2 out there. So TREM2, YKL are very good markers for inflammation. And as we shared with you, I think, in the last time, it's for the time being, we didn't have sufficiently robust data to really show what happens to pyroglu-Abeta in the spinal fluid. We had a very sensitive, and not only sensitive, a very specific assay in place, but when we looked into the CSF samples, we had to realize that the level was, which we could identify around the lower level of quantification. So the result was not reliably enough, and that triggered the next step that we wanted to further increase by using a different type of technique. There is a lot going on so that we can really have a reliable assay, because that would, of course, be great. The reason for that is that the level of pyroglu-Abeta in the brain is, of course, very high. That has been shown quite comprehensively. However, the level of pyroglu-Abeta, our entity here, that is extremely low in the spinal fluid. So it's more in the femtogram per mil, and that's low, I can tell you. So, but we are going there and looking into it. So there is also an option. You might have seen that people now start to look into neuronal microsomes catching the microRNAs. This is a new area of looking into biomarker, which also gives us not only a treatment effect, but also information about probably stratifying patients. But that is more later on. So in general, we will stick to those markers which are related to our concept, and that is synapses, that is NFL, goes with axons. It's earlier than tau. And, so that's basically what we have in the inflammatory part.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Next question is from Matt Cooper, Trinity Delta. Your line is now open, sir.
Thank you. Just one question about safety. Given the potential of condition approval, I was wondering if you could share with us any discussions that you've had with regulatory agencies about the level of the safety data that you need to provide. I'm just thinking from the point of view that the number of patients with AD and that they may be on your drug for many years, assuming everything goes to plan.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's a little early to tell. That will, of course, be our focus and the first approach with the FDA. We are now in the process of setting up an IND. That will, of course, be of high importance and on top of our list. And so what we have to have in mind, and we will find out quite soon, whether the titration already takes care of it. And there are quite a number of other medications where you have to titrate. And the titration is to go under the ceiling, kind of, under the trigger point of inducing these side effects and creating a kind of adaptation. That's not unusual. That is something which we will try, of course. And then the second point which we will modify is the dose. It might well be that with the 300 milligram BID, which still gives us 70% target occupancy, has no issue at all. That's one point. The other point is you have to consider when we did the SAPPHIRE, we had no clue. We had no clue in patients what to look at. So we couldn't have instructions to the investigators and how they should handle it and what to do when it occurs. So that very often helps and is a prerequisite to keep side effects in proportion, if I may say so. And that will also pay back when we have that now included. So, dear doctor, if you see this and that, has been seen before, and the recommendation is do this and that. So this is this type of suggestions to the investigator, that they are sensitized for the type of side effects. And you see what we have seen is skin and a little bit GI, which is higher than in the placebo, but not in the all other clinical chemical which indicates for kidney and for liver and bile and whatsoever. And so we can easily follow and see and handle that. So we are convinced that we will know much, much more when we had the chance to titrate and go down with the dose somewhat, that we still have a very comfortable target occupancy, but the absolute level of compound is reduced to 40% or even 20%.
Thank you.
As far as there are no further questions, I will hand back to the speakers.
Okay, thank you. I think this teleconference is now concluded. We thank everybody for participating, listening, and also for asking questions. We look very much forward to an interesting and challenging year 2018 along the discussions we had. Thanks a lot and goodbye.
Thank you. Thanks for your questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance. This call has been concluded. You may disconnect.